Chapter 10. Property. Jack Valenti has been the president of the Motion Picture Association of America since 1966. He first came to Washington, D.C. with Lyndon Johnson's administration, literally. The famous picture of Johnson swearing in on Air Force One after the assassination of President Kennedy has Valenti in the background. In his almost 40 years of running the MPAA, Valenti has established himself as perhaps the most prominent and effective lobbyist in Washington. The MPAA is the American branch of the International Motion Picture Association. It was formed in 1922 as a trade association whose goal was to defend American movies against increasing domestic criticism. The organization now represents not only filmmakers, but producers and distributors of entertainment for television, video, and cable. Its board is made up of the chairman and president of seven major producers and distributors of motion picture and television programs in the United States: Walt Disney, Sony Pictures Entertainment, MGM, Paramount Pictures, 20th Century Fox, Universal Studios, and Warner Brothers. Valenti is only the third president of the MPAA. No president before him has had as much influence over that organization or over Washington. As a Texan, Valenti has mastered the single most important political skill of a Southerner: the ability to appear simple and slow while hiding a lightning-fast intellect. To this day, Valenti plays the simple, humble man, but this Harvard MBA and author of four books, who finished high school at the age of 15 and flew more than 50 combat missions in World War II, is no Mr. Smith. When Valenti went to Washington, he mastered the city in a quintessentially Washingtonian way. In defending artistic liberty and the freedom of speech that our culture demands upon, the MPAA has done important good. In crafting the MPAA rating system, it has probably avoided a great deal of speech regulation harm. But there is an aspect of the organization's mission that is both the most radical and most important. This is the organization's effort, epitomized in the Valenti's every act, to redefine the meaning of creative property. In 1982, Valenti's testimony to Congress captured the strategy perfectly. No matter the lengthy arguments made, no matter the charges and the countercharges, no matter the tumult and the shouting, reasonable men and women will keep returning to the fundamental issue, the central theme which animates this entire debate. Creative property owners must be accorded the same rights and protection resident in all other property owners in the nation. That is the issue. That is the question, and that is the rostrum on which this entire hearing and debates to follow must rest. The strategy of this rhetoric, like the strategy of most of Valenti's rhetoric, is brilliant and simple, and brilliant because simple. The central theme to which reasonable men and women will return is this: creative property owners must be accorded the same rights and protections resident in all other property owners in the nation. There is no second-class citizens. Valenti might have continued, there should be no second-class property owners. This claim has an obvious and powerful intuitive pull. It is stated with such clarity as to make the idea as obvious as the notion that we use elections to pick presidents. But in fact, there is no more extreme a claim made by anyone who is serious in this debate than this claim of Valenti's. Jack Valenti, however sweet and however brilliant, is perhaps the nation's foremost extremist when it comes to the nature and scope of creative property. His views have no reasonable connection to our actual legal tradition. Even if the subtle pull of his Texan charm has slowly redefined that tradition, at least in Washington. While creative property is certainly property, in a nerdy and precise sense that lawyers are trained to understand, it has never been the case, nor should it be, that creative property owners have been accorded the same rights and protection resident in all other property owners. Indeed, if creative property owners were given the same rights as all other property owners, that would effect a radical and radically undesirable change in our tradition. Valenti knows this, but he speaks for an industry that cares squat for our traditions and values it represents. He speaks for an industry that is instead fighting to restore the tradition that the British overturned in 1710. In the world that Valenti's change would create, a powerful fuel would exercise powerful control over how our creative culture would develop. I have two purposes in this chapter. The first is to convince you that historically, Valenti's claim is absolutely wrong. The second is to convince you that it would be terribly wrong for us to reject our history. We have always treated rights in a creative property differently from the rights resident in all other property owners. They have never been the same, and they should never be the same, because however counterintuitive this may seem, to many them the same would be fundamentally weaken the opportunity for new creators to create. Creativity depends upon the owners of creativity having less than perfect control. Organizations such as the MPAA, whose board includes the most powerful of the old guard, have little interest in their rhetoric notwithstanding in assuring that the new can displace them. No organization does, no person does. Ask me about tenure, for example. But when that's good for the MPAA, but what's good for the MPAA is not necessarily good for America. A society that defends the ideals of a free culture must preserve precisely the opportunity for new creativity to threaten the old. To get just a hint that there is something fundamentally wrong in Valenti's argument, we need to look no further than the United States Constitution itself. The framers of the Constitution loved property. Indeed, so strongly did they love property that they built into the Constitution an important requirement. If the government takes your property, if it condemns your house or acquires a slice of your land from your farm, it is required under the Fifth Amendment's Takings Clause to pay you just compensation for that taking. The Constitution thus guarantees that property is, in a certain sense, sacred. It cannot ever be taken from the property owners unless the government pays for that privilege. Yet the very same Constitution speaks very differently about what Valenti calls creative property. In the clause granting Congress the power to create creative property, the Constitution requires that after a limited time, Congress take back the rights that it has granted and set the creative property free to the public domain. Yet when Congress does this, when the expiration of a copyright term takes your copyright and turns it over to the public domain, Congress does not have any obligation to pay. Just compensation for this taking. Instead, the Constitution that requires compensation for your land requires that you lose your creative property right without any compensation at all. The Constitution thus, on its face, states that these two forms of property are not to be accorded the same rights. They are plainly to be treated differently. Valenti is therefore not just asking for a change in our tradition when he argues that creative property owners should be accorded the same rights as every other property right owner. He is effectively arguing for a change in our Constitution itself. Arguing for a change in our Constitution is not necessarily wrong. There was much in our original Constitution that was plainly wrong. The Constitution of 1789 entrenched slavery. It left senators to be appointed rather than elected. It made it possible for the Electoral College to produce a tie between the president and its own vice president, as it did in 1800. The framers were no doubt extraordinary, but I would be the first to admit that they made big mistakes. We have since rejected some of these mistakes. No doubt there could be others that we should reject as well. So my argument is not simply that because Jefferson did it, we should too. Instead, my argument is that because Jefferson did it, we should at least try to understand why. Why did the framers, fanatical property types that they were, reject the claim that creative property be given the same rights as all other property? Why did they require that for creative property, there must be a public domain? To answer this question, we need to get some perspective on the history of these creative property rights and the control that they enabled. Once we see clearly how differently these rights have been defined, we will be in a better position to ask the question that should be at the core of this war, not whether creative property should be protected, but how. Not whether we will enforce the rights to the law given to creative property owners, but what that particular mix of rights ought to be. Not whether artists should be paid, but whether institutions designed to assure that artists get paid need also control how culture develops. To answer these questions, we need a more general way to talk about how property is protected. More precisely, we need a more general way than the narrow language of the law allows. In Code and Other Laws of Cyberspace, I used a simple model to capture this more general perspective. For any particular right or regulation, this model how four different modularities of regulation interact to support or weaken the right or regulation. I represent it with this diagram. The diagram is a picture of a cross between law, market, architecture, and norms, all coming to the center. At the center of this picture is a regulated dot. The individual or group that the target of regulation or the holder of a right, in each case throughout, we can describe this either as a regulation or a right. For simplicity's sake, I will speak only of regulations. The ovals represent four ways in which the individual or group might be regulated, either constrained or, alternatively, enabled. Law is the most obvious constraint, to lawyers at least. It constrains by threatening punishments after the fact if the rules set in advance are violated. So if, for example, you willfully infringe Madonna's copyright by copying a song from her latest CD and posting it on the web, you can be punished with a $150,000 fine. The fine is an ex post punishment for violating an ex ante rule. It is imposed by the state. Norms are a different kind of constraint. They, too, punish an individual for violating a rule. But the punishment of a norm is imposed by a community, not only by the state. There may be no law against spitting, but that doesn't mean you won't be punished if you spit on the ground while standing in a line at a movie. The punishment might not be harsh, though, depending on the community, it could easily be more harsh than many of the punishments imposed by the state. The mark of the difference is not the severity of the rule, but the source of the enforcement. The market is a third type of constraint. Its constraint is affected through conditions. You can do X if you pay Y. You'll be paid M if you do N. These constraints are obviously not independent or of laws or norms. It is property law that defines what must be bought if it is to be taken legally. It is norms that say what is appropriately sold. But given a set of norms and a background of property and contract law, the market imposes a simultaneous constraint upon how an individual or group might behave. Finally, and for the moment perhaps the most mysteriously, architecture, the physical world, as one finds it, is a constraint on behavior. A fallen bridge might constrain your ability to get across a river. Railroad tracks might constrain the ability of a community to integrate its social life. As with the market, architecture does not affect its constraint through ex post punishment. Instead, also with the market, architecture affects its constraint through simultaneous conditions. These conditions are imposed not by courts enforcing contracts or by police punishing theft, but by nature, by architecture. If a 500-pound boulder blocks your way, it is the law of gravity that enforces this constraint. If a $500 airplane ticket stands between you and a flight to New York, it is the market that enforces this constraint. So, the first point about these four modalities of regulation is obvious. They interact. Restrictions imposed by one might be reinforced by another, or restrictions imposed by one might be undermined by another. The second point follows directly. If we want to understand the effective freedom that anyone has at a given moment to do any particular thing, we have to consider how these four modalities interact. Whether or not these are other constraints. There may well be. My claim is not about comprehensiveness. These four are among the most significant, and any regulator, whether controlling or freeing, must consider how these four in particular interact. So, for example, consider the freedom to drive a car at high speed. That freedom is in part restricted by laws, speed limits that say how fast you can drive in particular places at particular times. It is in part restricted by architecture, speed bumps, for example, slow most rational drivers. Governors in buses, as another example, set the maximum rate at which the driver can drive. The freedom is in part restricted by the market. Fuel efficiency drops as speed increases, thus the price of gasoline indirectly constrains speed. And finally, the norms in a community may or may not constrain the freedom to speed. Drive at 50 miles per hour by a school in your own neighborhood, and you're likely to be punished by the neighbors. The same norm wouldn't be as effective in a different town or at night. There's now an image of the same cross, law, market, architecture, and norms coming together in the center. Law pointing to norms and market, and also to architecture. The final point about this simple model should also be fairly clear. While these four modalities are analytically independent, law has a special role in affecting the three. The law, in other words, sometimes operates to increase or decrease the constraint of a particular modality. Thus, the law might be used to increase taxes on gasoline so as to increase the incentives to drive more slowly. The law might be used to mandate more speed bumps so as to increase the difficulty of driving rapidly. The law might be used to fund ads that stigmatize reckless driving, or the law might be used to require that other laws be more strict, a federal requirement that states decrease the speed limit, for example, so as to decrease the attractiveness of fast driving. These constraints can thus change, and they can be changed. To understand the effective protection of a liberty or protection of property at the particular moment, we must track these changes over time. A restriction imposed by one modality might be erased by another. A freedom enabled by one modality might be displaced by another. Why Hollywood is right. The most obvious point that this model reveals is just why, or just how, Hollywood is right. The copyright warriors have rallied against Congress and the courts to defend copyright. This model helps us to see why that rallying makes sense. Let's say this is a picture of copyrights regulation before the Internet. It's the same picture of law, market, architecture, and norms coming together to a spot in the center. There's a balance between law, norms, market, and architecture. The laws limit the ability to copy and share content by imposing penalties on those who copy and share content. Those penalties are reinforced by technologies that make it hard to copy and share content, architecture, and expensive to copy and share content, market. Finally, those penalties are mitigated by norms we all recognize. Kids, for example, taping other kids' records. These use of copyrighted materials may well be an infringement, but the norms of our society, before the Internet at least, had no problem with this form of infringement. Enter the Internet, or more precisely, technology such as MP3s and P2P sharing. Now the constraint of architecture changes dramatically, as does the constraint of the market. And both the market and the architecture relax the regulations of copyright. Norms pile on. The happy balance, for the warriors at least, of life before the Internet becomes an effective state of anarchy after the Internet. Thus the sense of and justification for the warriors' response. Technology has changed, the warriors say, and the effect of this change, when ramified through the market and norms, is that a balance of protection for the copyright owner's rights has been lost. The same image of law, market, architecture, norms coming to a spot in the center, only the spot is a lot larger. This is Iraq after the fall of Saddam, but this time no government is justifying looting that results. Neither this analysis nor the conclusions that follow are new to the warriors. Indeed, in a white paper prepared by the Commerce Department, one heavily influenced by the copyright warriors, in 1995, this mix of regulatory modalities had already been identified and the strategy to respond already mapped. In response to the changes the Internet had affected, the white paper argued 1. Congress should strengthen the intellectual property law. 2. Businesses should adopt innovative marketing techniques. 3. Technologists should push to develop code to protect copyrighted material. And 4. Educators should educate kids to better protect copyright. This mixed strategy is just what copyright needed, if it was to preserve the particular balance that existed before the change induced by the Internet. And it's just what we should expect the content industry to push for. It is as American as apple pie to consider the happy life you have as an entitlement, and to look to the law to protect it. If something comes along to change that happy life, homeowners living in a floodplain have no hesitation appealing to the government to rebuild and rebuild again when the flood architecture wipes away their property law. Farmers have no hesitation appealing to the government to bail them out when a virus architecture devastates their crop. Unions have no hesitation appealing to the government to bail them out when imports market wipe out the U.S. steel industry. Thus, there's nothing wrong or surprising that the content industry's campaign to protect itself from the harmful consequences of a technological innovation. And I would be the last person to argue that the changing technology of the Internet has not had a profound effect on the content industry's way of doing business, or as John Seely Brown describes it, its architecture of revenue. But just because a particular interest asks for government support, it doesn't follow that support should be granted. And just because technology has weakened a particular way of doing business, it doesn't follow that the government should intervene to support that old way of doing business. Kodak, for example, has lost perhaps as much as 20% of their traditional market, film market, to the emerging technologies of digital cameras. Does anyone believe that the government should ban digital cameras just to support Kodak? Highways have weakened the freight business for railroads. Does anyone think that we should ban trucks from the roads for the purpose of protecting the railroads? Closer to the subject of this book, remote channel changers have weakened the stickiness of television advertising. If a boring commercial comes on the TV, the remote makes it easy to surf. And it may well be that this change has weakened the television advertising market. But does anyone believe we should regulate remotes to reinforce commercial television? Maybe by limiting them to function only once a second, or to switch only 10 channels within an hour? The obvious answer to these obviously rhetorical questions is no. In a free society with a free market supported by free enterprise and free trade, the government's role is not to support one way of doing business against others. Its role is not to pick winners and protect them against loss. If the government did this generally, then we would never have any progress. As Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates wrote in 1991 in a memo criticizing software patents, established companies have an interest in excluding future competitors. And relative to a startup, established companies also have the means, think RCA and FM radio, a world in which competitors with new ideas must fight not only the market, but also the government, is a world in which competitors with new ideas will not succeed. It is a world of stasis and increasingly concentrated stagnation. It is the Soviet Union under Brezhnev. Thus, while it is understandable for industries threatened with new technologies that change the way they do business to look to the government for protection, it is the special duty of policymakers to guarantee that that protection not become a deterrent to progress. It is the duty of policymakers, in other words, to assure that the changes they create in response to the request of those hurt by changing technologies are changes that preserve the incentives and opportunities for innovation and change. In the context of laws regulating speech, which include, obviously, copyright law, that duty is even stronger. When the industry complaining about changing technologies is asking Congress to respond in a way that burdens speech and creativity, policymakers should be especially wary of the request. It is always a bad deal for the government to get into the business of regulating speech markets. The risks and dangers of that game are precisely why our framers created the First Amendment to our Constitution. Congress shall make no law, abridge the freedom of speech. So when Congress is being asked to pass laws that would abridge the freedom of speech, it should ask carefully whether such regulation is justified. My argument just now, however, has nothing to do with whether the changes are being pushed by the copyright warriors are justified. My argument is about their effect. For before we get to the question of justification, a hard question that depends on a great deal upon your values, we should first ask whether we understand the effects of the changes the content industry wants. Here's the metaphor that will capture the arguments to follow. In 1873, the chemical DDT was first synthesized. In 1948, Swiss chemist Paul Hermann Muller won the Nobel Prize for his work demonstrating the insecticidal properties of DDT. By the 1950s, the insecticide was widely used around the world to kill disease-carrying pests. It was also used to increase farm production. No one doubts that killing disease-carrying pests or increasing crop production is a good thing. No one doubts that the work of Mueller was important and valuable and probably saved lives, possibly millions. But in 1962, Rachel Carson published Silent Spring, which argued that DDT, whatever its primary benefits, was also having unintended environmental consequences. Birds were losing the ability to reproduce. Whole chains of the ecology were being destroyed. No one set out to destroy the environment. Paul Mueller certainly did not aim to harm any birds, but the effort to solve one set of problems produced another set, which in the view of some was far worse than the problems that were originally attacked. Or more accurately, the problems DDT caused were worse than the problems that it solved, at least when considering the other, more environmentally friendly ways to solve the problems that DDT was meant to solve. It is to this image precisely that Duke University law professor James Boyle appeals when he argues that we need an environmentalism for culture. His point, or the point I want to develop in the balance of this chapter, is not that the aims of copyright are flawed, or that authors should not be paid for their work, or that music should not be given away for free. The point is that some of the ways in which we might protect authors will have unintended consequences for the cultural environment, much like DDT had for the natural environment. And just as criticism of DDT is not an endorsement of malaria or an attack on farmers, so too is criticism of one particular set of regulations protecting copyright not an endorsement of anarchy or attacks on authors. It is an environment of creativity that we seek, and we should be aware of our actions' effect on that environment. My argument, in the balance of this chapter, tries to map exactly this effect. No doubt the technology of the Internet has had a dramatic effect on the ability of copyright owners to protect their content. But there should also be little doubt that when you add together the changes in copyright law over time, plus the changes in technology that the Internet is undergoing just now, the net effect of these changes will not be only that copyright work is effectively protected, also, and generally missed, the net effect of this massive increase in protection will be devastating to the environment for creativity. In a line, to kill a gnat, we are spraying DDT with the consequences for free culture that will be far more devastating than that gnat will be lost. Beginnings. America copied English copyright law. Actually, we copied the improved English copyright law. Our Constitution makes the purpose of creative property rights clear. Its express limitations reinforce the English aim to avoid overly powerful publishers. The power to establish creative property rights is granted to Congress in a way that, for our Constitution at least, is very odd. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 8 of our Constitution states that Congress has the power to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. We can call this the Progress Clause, for notice that this clause does not say. It does not say Congress has the power to grant creative property rights. It says that Congress has the power to promote progress. The grant of power is its purpose, and its purpose is a public one, not the purpose of enriching publishers, nor even primarily the purpose of rewarding authors. The Progress Clause expressly limits the term of copyrights. As we saw in Chapter 6, the English limited the term of copyrights so as to assure that a few would not exercise disproportionate control over culture by exercising disproportionate control over publishing. We can assume that the framers followed the English for a similar purpose. Indeed, unlike the English, the framers reinforced that objective by requiring that copyrights extend to the authors only. The design of the Progress Clause reflects something about the Constitution's design in general. To avoid a problem, the framers built structure. to prevent the concentrated powers of publisher, they built a structure that kept copyrights away from publishers and kept them short. To prevent the concentrated power of a church, they banned the federal government from establishing a church. To prevent concentrating power in the federal government, they built structures to reinforce the power of the states, including the Senate, whose members were at the time selected by the states, and an electoral college, also selected by the states to select the president. In each case, a structure built checks and balances into the Constitution frame, structured to prevent otherwise inevitable concentrations of power. I doubt the framers would recognize the regulations we call copyright today. The scope of that regulation is far beyond anything they ever considered. To begin to understand what they did, we need to put our copyright in context. We need to see how it has changed in the 210 years since they first struck its design. Some of these changes come from the law, some in light of changes in technology, and some in light of changes in technology given a particular concentration of market power. In terms of our model, we started here. The same image, law, market, architecture, norms coming together to a dot in the center. We will end here, a much larger law, much larger market, much larger architecture, and the same or smaller norms coming together to a dot in the center. Let me explain how. When the first Congress enacted laws to protect creative property, it faced the same uncertainty about the status of creative property that the English has confronted in 1774. Many states had passed laws protecting creative property, and some believed that these laws simply supplemented common law rights that had already protected creative authorship. This meant that there was no guaranteed public domain in the United States in 1790. If copyrights were protected by the common law, then there was no simple way to know whether a work published in the United States was controlled or free. Just as in England, this lingering uncertainty would make it hard for publishers to rely upon a public domain to reprint and redistribute works. That uncertainty ended after Congress passed legislation granting copyrights. Because federal law overrides any contrary state law, federal protections for copyrighted works displaced any state law protections. Just as in England, the Statute of Anne eventually meant that copyrights for all English works expired. A federal statute meant that any state copyrights expired as well. In 1790, Congress enacted the first copyright law. It created a federal copyright and secured that copyright for 14 years. If the author was alive at the end of that 14 years, then he could opt to renew the copyright for another 14 years. If he did not renew the copyright, his work passed into the public domain. While there were many works created in the United States in the first 10 years of the Republic, only 5% of the works were actually registered under the federal copyright regime. Of all the work created in the United States, both before 1790 and from 1790 through 1800, 95% immediately passed into the public domain. The balance would pass into public domain within 28 years at most, and more likely within 14 years. This system of renewal was a crucial part of the American system of copyright. It assured that the maximum term of copyright would be granted only for works where they were wanted. After the initial term of 14 years, if it wasn't worth it to the author to renew his copyright, then it wasn't worth it to society to insist on the copyright either. 14 years may not seem long to us, but for the vast majority of copyright owners at that time, it was long enough. Only a small minority of them renewed their copyrights after 14 years. The balance allowed their work to pass into the public domain. Even today, this structure would make sense. Most creative work has an actual commercial life of just a couple of years. Most books fall out of print after 1 year. When that happens, the used books are traded free of copyright regulation. Thus, the books are no longer effectively controlled by copyright. The only practical commercial use of the books at that time is to sell the books as used books. That use, because it does not involve publication, is effectively free. In the first 100 years of the Republic, the term of copyright was changed once. In 1831, the term was increased from a maximum of 28 years to a maximum of 42 by increasing the initial terms of copyright from 14 years to 28 years. In the next 50 years of the Republic, the term increased once again in 1909. Congress extended the renewal term of 14 years to 28 years, setting a maximum term of 56 years. Then, beginning in 1962, Congress started a practice that has defined copyright law since. 11 times in the last 40 years, Congress has extended the terms of existing copyrights. Twice in those 40 years, Congress extended the term of future copyrights. Initially, the extensions of existing copyrights were short, a mere 1 or 2 years. In 1976, Congress extended all existing copyrights by 19 years. And in 1998, in the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act, Congress extended the term of existing and future copyrights by 20 years. The effect of these extensions is simply to toll or delay the passing of works into public domain. This latest extension means that the public domain will have been tolled for 39 out of 55 years, or 70% of the time, since 1962. Thus, in the 20 years after the Sonny Bono Act, while 1 million patents will pass into the public domain, zero copyrights will pass into the public domain by virtue of the expiration of copyright term. The effect of these extensions has been exacerbated by another little-noticed change in the copyright law. Remember I said that the framers established a two-part copyright regime requiring a copyright owner to renew his copyright after an initial term. The requirement of renewal meant that works that no longer needed copyright protection would pass more quickly into the public domain. The works remaining under protection would be those that had some continuing commercial value. The United States abandoned this sensible system in 1976. For all works created after 1978, there was only one copyright term, the maximum term. For natural authors, the term was life plus 50 years. For corporations, the term was 75 years. Then in 1992, Congress abandoned the renewal requirement for all works created before 1978. All works still under copyright would be accorded the maximum term then available. After the Sonny Bono Act, that term was 95 years. This change meant that American law no longer had an automatic way to assure that works that were no longer exploited passed into the public domain. And indeed, after these changes, it is unclear whether it is even possible to put works into public domain. The public domain is orphaned by these changes in copyright law. Despite the requirement that terms be limited, we have no evidence that anything will limit them. The effect of these changes on the average duration of copyright is dramatic. In 1973, more than 85% of copyright owners failed to renew their copyright. That meant that the average term of copyright in 1973 was just 32.2 years. Because of the elimination of the renewal requirement, the average term of copyright is now the maximum term. In 30 years, then, the average term has tripled from 32.2 years to 95 years. Law, scope. The scope of a copyright is the range of rights granted by the law. The scope of American copyright has changed dramatically. Those changes are not necessarily bad, but we should understand the extent of the changes if we're to keep this debate in context. In 1970, that scope was very narrow. Copyright covered only maps, charts, and books. That meant it didn't, for example, cover music or architecture. More significantly, the right granted by a copyright gave the author exclusive rights to publish copyrighted works. That meant someone else violated the copyright only if he republished the works, without the copyright owner's permission. Finally, the right granted a copyright was an exclusive right to that particular book. The right did not extend to what lawyers call derivative works. It would not, therefore, interfere with the right of someone other than the author to translate a copyright book or to adapt the story to a different form, such as a drama based on a published book. This, too, has changed dramatically. While the contours of copyright law are extremely hard to describe, simply, in general terms, the right covers practically any creative works that is reduced to a tangible form. It covers music as well as architecture, drama as well as computer programs. It gives the copyright owner of that creative work not only the exclusive right to publish the work, but also exclusive right of control over any copies of that work. And most significant for our purposes here, the right gives copyright owners control not only over his or her particular work, but also any derivative work that might grow out of the original work. In this way, the right covers more creative work, protects the creative work more broadly, and protects the works that are based in a significant way on the initial creative work. At the same time that the scope of copyright has expanded, procedural limitations on the right have been relaxed. I've already described the complete removal of the renewal requirement in 1992. In addition to the renewal requirement for most of the history of American copyright law, there was a requirement that a work be registered before it could receive the protection of a copyright. There was also a requirement that any copyrighted works be marked either with that famous C or the word copyright. And for the most part of the history of American copyright law, there was a requirement that works be deposited with the government before a copyright could be secured. The reason for the registration requirement was the sensible understanding that for most works, no copyright was required. Again, in the first 10 years of the Republic, 90% of the works eligible for copyright were never copyrighted. Thus, the rule reflected the norm. Most works apparently didn't need copyright, so registration was narrowed to the regulation of the law to the few that did. The same reasoning justified the requirement that a work be marked as copyrighted. That way, it was easy to know whether a copyright was being claimed. The requirement that works be deposited was to assure that after the copyright expired, there would be a copy of the work somewhere, so that it could be copied by others without locating the original author. All of these formalities were abolished by the American system when we decided to follow European copyright law. There is no requirement that you register a work to get copyright. The copyright now is automatic. The copyright exists whether or not you mark your work with a copyright C, and the copyright exists whether or not you actually make a copy available to others to copy. Consider a practical example to understand the scope of these differences. If, in 1970, you wrote a book that you were one of the 5% who actually copyrighted the book, then the copyright law protected you against another publisher's taking of your book and republishing it without your permission. The aim of the act was to regulate publishers so as to prevent that kind of unfair competition. In 1970, there were 174 publishers in the United States. The Copyright Act was thus a tiny regulation of a tiny proportion of a tiny part of the creative market in the United States, publishers. The Act left other creators totally unregulated. If I copied your poem by hand over and over again, as a way to learn it by heart, my act was totally unregulated by the 1790 Act. If I took your novel and made a play based upon it, or if I translated it or abridged it, none of those activities were regulated by the original Copyright Act. These creative activities remained free, while the activities of publishers were restrained. Today, the story is very different. If you write a book, your book is automatically protected. Indeed, not just your book. Every email, every note to your spouse, every doodle, every creative act that's reduced to a tangible form, all of this is automatically copyrighted. There is no need to register or mark your work. The protection follows the creation, not the steps you take to protect it. That protection gives you the right, subject to a narrow range of fair use exceptions, to control how others copy the work, whether they copy it or copy it to republish it or share an excerpt. That much is the obvious part. Any system of copyright would control competing publishing. But there's a second part to the copyright of today that is not at all obvious. This is the protection of derivative rights. If you write a book, no one can make a movie out of your book without permission. No one can translate it without permission. Cliff Notes can't make an abridgment unless permission is granted. All of these derivative uses of your original work are controlled by the copyright holder. The copyright, in other words, is now not just an exclusive right to your writings, but an exclusive right to your writings and a large proportion of the writings inspired by them. It is this derivative right that would seem most bizarre to our framers, though it has become second nature to us. Initially, this expansion was created to deal with obvious evasions of a narrower copyright. If I write a book, can you change one word and then claim a copyright in a new and different book? Obviously, that would make a joke of the copyright. So the law was prepared, properly expanded, to exclude those slight modifications, as well as a verbatim original work. In preventing that joke, the law created an astonishing power within free culture. At least it's astonishing when you understand that the law applies not just to commercial publishers, but to anyone with a computer. I understand the wrong in duplicating and selling someone else's work, but whatever that wrong is, transforming someone else's work is a different wrong. Some view transformation as no wrong at all. They believe that our law, as the framers penned it, should not protect derivative rights at all. Whether or not you go that far, it seems plain that whatever wrong is involved is fundamentally different from the wrong of direct piracy. Yet copyright law treats these two different wrongs in the same way. I can go to court and get an injunction against your printing my book. I can go to court and get an injunction against your transformative use of my book. These two different uses of my creative work are treated the same. This again may seem right to you. If I wrote a book, then why should you be able to write a movie that takes my story and makes money from it without paying or crediting me? Or if Disney creates a creature called Mickey Mouse, why should you be able to make Mickey Mouse toys and be the one to trade on the value of that Disney originally created? These are good arguments, and, in general, my point is not that the derivative right is unjustified. My aim, just now, is much narrower, simply to make clear that this expansion is a significant change from the rights originally granted. Law and architecture. Reach. Whereas originally the law regulated only publishers, the change in copyright scope means that the law today regulates publishers, users, and authors. It regulates them because all three are capable of making copies, and the core of the regulation of copyright law is copies. Copies. That certainly sounds like the obvious thing for copyright law to regulate. But as with Jack Valenti's argument at the start of this chapter, that creative property deserves the same rights as all other property, it is the obvious that we need to be most careful about. For while it may be obvious that in the world before the Internet, copies were the obvious trigger for copyright law upon reflection, it should be obvious that in the world with the Internet, copies should not be the trigger for copyright law. More precisely, they should not always be the trigger for copyright law. This is perhaps the central claim of this book, so let me take this very slowly so that the point is not easily missed. My claim is that the Internet should at least force us to rethink the conditions under which the law of copyright automatically applies, because it is clear that the current reach of copyright was never contemplated, much less chosen, by the legislators who enacted copyright law. We can see this point abstractly by beginning with this largely empty circle, a picture of an empty circle with the word uses in it. Think about a book in real space, and imagine this circle to represent all its potential uses. Much of these uses are unregulated by copyright law. Because the uses don't create a copy, if you read a book, the act is not regulated by copyright law. If you give someone the book, the act is not regulated by copyright law. If you resell a book, the act is not regulated. Copyright law expressly states that after the first sale of the book, the copyright owner can impose no further condition on the disposition of the book. If you sleep on the book, or use it to hold up a lamp, or let your puppy chew on it, those acts are not regulated by copyright law, because those acts do not make a copy. Now an image of the same circle with unregulated written at the top of it, a picture of someone reading a book, a picture of someone giving a book away, a picture of someone reselling a book, and a picture of someone sleeping on a book. Obviously, however, some uses of a copyrighted book are regulated by copyright law. Republishing the book, for example, makes a copy. It is therefore regulated by copyright law. Indeed, this particular use stands at the core of the circle of possible uses of a copyrighted work. It is this paradigmatic use properly regulated by copyright regulation. Finally, there is a tiny sliver of otherwise regulated copyright uses that remain unregulated because of the law. A picture of the same circle with unregulated at the top and the copyright symbol in the center of it. Consider these fair uses. Same picture with a magnifying glass over a corner of the copyright law showing a skinny circle around it that says fair use. These are uses that themselves involve copying, but which the law treats as unregulated because public policy demands that they remain unregulated. You are free to quote from this book, even in a review that is quite negative, without my permission, even though that quoting makes a copy. That copy would ordinarily give the copyright owner the exclusive right to say whether the copy is allowed or not, but the law denies the owner any exclusive right over such fair uses for public policy, and possibly First Amendment reasons. In real space, then, the possible uses of a book are divided into three sorts. 1. Unregulated uses. 2. Regulated uses. And 3. Regulated uses that are nonetheless deemed fair, regardless of the copyright owner's view. Another image of the same circle, with a large circle in the middle that says regulated. And a picture of someone looking with an exclamation point above their head. Enter the Internet. A distributed digital network where every use of a copyrighted work produces a copy. And because of this single arbitrary feature of the design of a digital network, the scope of category 1 changes dramatically. Uses that were before presumptively unregulated are now presumptively regulated. No longer is there a set of presumptively unregulated uses that define a freedom associated with a copyrighted work. Instead, each use is now subject to the copyright. Because each use also makes a copy category, 1 gets sucked into category 2. And those who would defend the unregulated use of copyrighted work must look exclusively to category 3, fair uses, to bear the burden of this shift. So let's be very specific to make this general point clear. Before the Internet, if you purchased a book and read it 10 times, there would be no plausible copyright-related argument that the copyright owner could make to control the use of her book. Copyright law would have nothing to say about whether you read the book once, 10 times, or every night before you went to bed. None of those instances of use, reading, could be regulated by the copyright law because none of those uses produced a copy. But the same book, as an e-book, is effectively governed by a different set of rules. Now, if the copyright owner says you may read the book only once or only once a month, then copyright law would aid the copyright owner in exercising this degree of control because of the accidental feature of copyright law that triggers its application upon there being a copy. Now, if you read the book 10 times and the license says you may only read it 5 times, then whenever you read the book, or any portion of it, beyond the 5th time, you are making a copy of the book contrary to the copyright owner's wish. There are some people who think that this makes perfect sense. My aim just now is not to argue about whether it makes sense or not. My aim is only to make clear the change. Once you see this point, a few other points also become clear. First, making Category 1 disappear is not anything any policymaker ever intended. Congress did not think through the collapse of the presumptively unregulated uses of copyright works. There is no evidence at all that policymakers had this idea in mind when they allowed our policy here to shift. Unregulated use were an important part of free culture before the Internet. Second, this shift is especially troubling in the context of transformative use of creative content. Again, we can all understand the wrong in commercial piracy, but the law now purports to regulate any transformation you make of a creative work using a machine. Copy and paste, cut and paste become crimes. Tinkering with a story and releasing it to others exposes the tinkerer to at least a requirement of justification. However troubling, the expansion with respect to copyright is a particular work. It is extraordinarily troubling with respect to transformative uses of creative work. Third, this shift from Category 1 to Category 2 puts an extraordinary burden on Category 3, fair use, that fair use never before had to bear. If a copyright owner now tried to control how many times I could read a book online, the natural response would be to argue that this is a violation of my fair use rights. But there has never been any litigation about whether I have a fair use right to read, because before the internet, reading did not trigger the application of copyright law, and hence the need for fair use defense. The right to read was effectively protected before because reading was not regulated. This point about fair use is totally ignored, even by advocates for free culture. We have been cornered into arguing that our rights depend upon fair use, never even addressing the earlier question about the expansion in effective regulation. A thin protection grounded in fair use makes sense when the vast majority of uses are unregulated. But when everything becomes presumptively regulated, then the protections of fair use are not enough. The case of Video Pipeline is a good example. Video Pipeline was in the business of making trailer advertisements for movies available to video stores. The video stores displayed the trailers as a way to sell videos. Video Pipeline got the trailers from the film distributors, put the trailers on tape, and sold the tapes to the retail stores. The company did this for about 15 years. Then, in 1997, it began to think about the internet as another way to distribute these previews. The idea was to expand their selling by sampling technique by giving online stores the same ability to enable browsing. Just as in a bookstore, you can read a few pages of a book before you buy the book, so, too, you would be able to sample a bit from the movie online before you bought it. In 1998, Video Pipeline informed Disney and other film distributors that it intended to distribute trailers through the internet rather than sending tapes to distribute their videos. 2 years later, Disney told Video Pipeline to stop. The owner of a Video Pipeline asked Disney to talk about the matter. He had built a business on distributing this content as a way to help sell Disney films. He had customers who depended upon his delivering this content. Disney would agree to talk only if Video Pipeline stopped the distribution immediately. Video Pipeline thought it was within their fair use rights to distribute the clips as they had, so they filed a lawsuit to ask the court to declare that these rights were, in fact, their rights. Disney countersued for $100 million in damages. Those damages were predicated upon a claim that Video Pipeline had willfully infringed on Disney's copyright. When a court makes a finding or willful infringement, it can award damages not on the basis of the actual harm to the copyright owner, but on the basis of an amount set in the statute. Because Video Pipeline had distributed 700 clips of Disney movies to enable video stores to sell copies of these movies, Disney was now suing Video Pipeline for $100 million. Disney has the right to control its property, of course. But the video stores that were selling Disney's film also had some sort of right to be able to sell the films that they had bought from Disney. Disney's claims in court was that the stores were allowed to sell the films, and they were permitted to list the titles of the films they were selling, but they were not allowed to show clips of the film as a way of selling them without Disney's permission. Now, you may think this is a closed case, and I think the courts would consider it a closed case. My point here is to map the changes that gives Disney this power. Before the internet, Disney couldn't really control how people got access to their content. Once a video was in the marketplace, the first sale doctrine would free the seller to use the video as he wished, including showing portions of it in order to engender sales of the entire movie video. But with the internet, it becomes possible for Disney to centralize control over access to this content. Because each use of the internet produces a copy, use on the internet becomes subject to the copyright owner's control. The technology expands the scope of effective control because the technology builds a copy into every transaction. No doubt, a potential is not yet an abuse, and so the potential for control is not yet the abuse of control. Barnes & Noble has the right to say you can't touch a book in their store. Property law gives them that right, but the market effectively protects against that abuse. If Barnes & Noble banned browsing, then consumers would choose other bookstores. Competition protects against the extremes. And it may well be, my argument so far does not even question this, that competition would prevent any similar damage when it comes to copyright. Sure, publishers exercising the rights that authors have assigned to them may try to regulate how many times you read a book or try to stop you from sharing the book with anyone, but in a competitive market such as the book market, the dangers of this happening are quite slight. Again, my aim so far is simply to map the changes that this changed architecture enables. Enabling technology to enforce the control of copyright means that the control of copyright is no longer defined by balanced policy. The control of copyright is simply what private owners choose. In some context, at least, that fact is harmless. But in some context, it is a recipe for disaster. Architecture and the Law. Force. The disappearance of regulated uses would be change enough, but a second important change brought about by the Internet magnifies its significance. This second change does not affect the reach of copyright regulation, it affects how such regulation is enforced. In the world before digital technology, it was generally the law that controlled whether and how someone was regulated by copyright law. The law, meaning a court, meaning a judge. In the end, it was human, trained in the tradition of the law and cognizant of the balances that tradition embraced, who said whether and how the law would restrict your freedom. There's a famous story about a battle between the Marx brothers and the Warner brothers. The Marxes intended to make a parody of Casablanca. Warner brothers objected. They wrote a nasty letter to the Marxes warning them that there would be serious legal consequences if they went forward with their plan. This led the Marx brothers to respond in kind. They warned Warner Brothers that the Marx brothers were brothers long before you were. The Marx brothers therefore owned the word brothers, and if Warner Brothers insisted on trying to control Casablanca, then the Marx brothers would insist on control over brothers. An absurd and hollow threat, of course, because Warner Brothers, like the Marx brothers, knew that no court would ever enforce such a silly claim. This extremism was irrelevant to the real freedoms anyone, including Warner Brothers, enjoyed. On the Internet, however, there is no check on silly rules, because on the Internet, increasingly, rules are enforced not by a human, but by a machine. Increasingly, the rules of copyright law, as interpreted by the copyright owner, get built into technology that delivers copyright content. It is code, rather than law, that rules. And the problem with code regulation is that, unlike law, code has no shame. Code would not get the humor of the Marx brothers. The consequence of that is not at all funny. Consider the life of my Adobe ebook reader. An ebook is a book delivered in electronic form. An Adobe ebook is not a book that Adobe published. Adobe simply produces the software that publishers use to deliver ebooks. It provides the technology, and the publisher delivers the content by using the technology. On the next page is a picture of an old version of my Adobe ebook reader. As you can see, I have a small collection of ebooks within this ebook library. Some of these books reproduce content that is in the public domain. Middlemarch, for example, is in the public domain. Some of them reproduce content that is not in the public domain. My own book, The Future of Ideas, is not yet within the public domain. Consider Middlemarch first. If you click my ebook copy of Middlemarch, you'll see a fancy cover and then a button at the bottom called Permissions. If you click on the Permissions button, you'll see a list of permissions that the publisher purports to grant with this book. According to my ebook reader, I have the permission to copy to the clipboard of the computer 10 text selections every 10 days. So far, I've copied no text to the clipboard. I also have the permission to print 10 pages from the book every 10 days. Lastly, I have the permission to use the Read Aloud button to hear Middlemarch read aloud through the computer. Here's the ebook for another work in the public domain, including the translation, Aristotle's Politics. According to its permission, no printing or copying is permitted at all. but fortunately, you can use the Read Aloud button to hear the book. Finally, and most embarrassingly, here are the permissions for the original ebook version of my last book, The Future of Ideas. No copying, no printing, and don't you dare try to listen to this book. Now, the Adobe eBook Reader calls these controls permissions, and if the publisher has the power to control how you use these works, for works under copyright, the copyright owner certainly does have the power, up to the limits of copyright law. But for work not under copyright, there is no such copyright power. When my ebook of Middlemarch says I have the permission to copy only 10 text selections into the memory every 10 days, what that really means is that the ebook reader has enabled the publisher to control how I use the book on my computer, far beyond the control that the law would enable. The control comes instead from code, from the technology within the ebook lives. Though the ebook says that these are permissions, they are not the sort of permissions that most of us deal with. When a teenager gets permission to stay out till midnight, she knows, unless she's Cinderella, that she can stay out until 2 a.m., but will suffer a punishment if she's caught. But when the ebook reader says that I have permission to make 10 copies of the text into the computer's memory, that means that after I've made 10 copies, the computer will not make any more. The same with printing restrictions. After 10 pages, the ebook reader will not print any more pages. It's the same with the silly restriction that says you can't use the Read Aloud button to read my book aloud. It's not that the company will sue you if you do. Instead, if you push the Read Aloud button with my book, the machine simply won't read aloud. These are controls, not permission. Imagine a world where the Marx Brothers sold word processing software when you tried to type Warner Brothers erased Brothers from the sentence. This is the future of copyright law, not so much copyright law as copyright code. The controls over access to content will not be controls that are ratified by the courts. The controls over access to content will be controlled that are coded by the programmers. And whereas the controls that are built into the law are always to be checked by a judge, the controls that are built into technology have no similar built-in check. How significant is this? Isn't it always possible to get around the controls built into technology? Software used to be sold with technologies that limited the ability of users to copy the software, but those were trivial protections to defeat. Why won't it be trivial to defeat these protections as well? We've only scratched the surface of this story. Return to the Adobe eBook Reader. Early in the life of the Adobe eBook Reader, Adobe suffered a public relations nightmare. Among the books that you could download for free on the Adobe site was a copy of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. This wonderful book is in the public domain, yet when you clicked on the permissions for that book, you got the following report. Here was a public domain children's book that you were not allowed to copy, not allowed to lend, not allowed to give, and as the permissions indicated, not allowed to read aloud. The public relations nightmare attached to that final permission. For the text did not say that you were not permitted to use the Read Aloud button, it said you did not have the permission to read the book aloud. That led some people to think that Adobe was restricting the rights of parents, for example, to read the book to their children, which seemed to say the least absurd. Adobe responded quickly that it was absurd to think that it was trying to restrict the right to read a book aloud. Obviously, it was only restricting the ability to use the Read Aloud button to have the book read aloud. But the question Adobe never did answer is this. Would Adobe thus agree that a consumer was free to use software to hack around the restrictions built into the ebook reader? If some company, call it Elcomsoft, developed a program to disable the technological protection built into the Adobe ebook so that a blind person, say, could use a computer to read the book aloud, would Adobe agree that such use of an ebook reader was fair? Adobe didn't answer because the answer, however absurd it might seem, is no. The point is not to blame Adobe. Indeed, Adobe is among the most innovative companies developing strategies to balance open access to content with incentives for companies to innovate. But Adobe's technology enables control, and Adobe has an incentive to defend this control. That incentive is understandable. Yet, what it creates is often crazy. To see the point in a particularly absurd context, consider a favorite story of mine that makes the same point. Consider the robotic dog made by Sony named Aibo. The Aibo learns tricks, cuddles, and follows you around. It eats only electricity that doesn't leave that much of a mess, at least in your house. The Aibo is expensive and popular. Fans from around the world have set up clubs to trade stories. One fan in particular set up a website to enable information about the Aibo to be shared. This fan set up AiboPet.com and AiboHack.com, but that resolves to the same site. And on that site, he provided information about how to teach an Aibo to do tricks in addition to the ones Sony had taught it. Teach here has special meaning. Aibos are just cute computers. You teach a computer how to do something by programming it differently. So to say that AiboPet.com was giving information about how to teach the dog to do new tricks is just to say that AiboPet.com was giving information to users of the AiboPet about how to hack their computer dog to make it do new tricks, thus AiboHack.com. If you're not a programmer or don't know many programmers, the word hack has a particularly unfriendly connotation. Non-programmers hack bushes or weeds. Non-programmers in horror movies do even worse. But to programmers, or coders, as I call them, hack is a much more positive term. Hack just means code that enables the program to do something it wasn't originally intended or enabled to do. If you buy a new printer for an old computer, you might find that the old computer doesn't run or drive the printer. If you discovered that, you'd later be happy to discover that a hack on the net by someone who has written a driver to enable the computer to drive the printer you just bought. Some hacks are easy. Some are unbelievably hard. Hackers, as a community, like to challenge themselves and others with increasingly difficult tasks. There's a certain respect that goes with the talent to hack well. There's a well-deserved respect that goes with the talent to hack ethically. The Aibo fan was displaying a bit of both when he hacked the program and offered to the world a bit of code that would enable the Aibo to dance jazz. The dog wasn't programmed to dance jazz. It was a clever bit of tinkering that turned the dog into a more talented creature than Sony had built. I've told this story in many contexts, both inside and outside the United States. Once I was asked by a puzzled member of the audience, "Is it permissible for a dog to dance jazz in the United States?" We forgot that stories about the backcountry still flow across much of the world, so let's just be clear before we continue. It's not a crime anywhere, anymore, to dance jazz. Nor is it a crime to teach your dog to dance jazz. Nor should it be a crime, though we don't have a lot to go on here, to teach your robot dog to dance jazz. Dancing jazz is completely legal activity. Once one imagines that the owner of AiboPet.com thought, what possible problem could there be in teaching a robot dog to dance? Let's put the dog to sleep for a minute and turn to a pony show. Not literally a pony show, but rather a paper that a Princeton academic named Ed Felton prepared for a conference. This Princeton academic is well known and respected. He was hired by the government in a Microsoft case to test Microsoft claims about what could and could not be done with its own code. In that trial, he demonstrated both his brilliance and his coolness. Under heavy badgering by Microsoft lawyers, Ed Felton stood his ground. He was not about to be bullied into being silent about something he knew very well. But Felton's bravery was really tested in April of 2001. He and a group of colleagues were working on a paper to be submitted at a conference. The paper intended to describe the weakness in an encryption system being developed by the Secure Digital Music Initiative as a technique to control the distribution of music. The SDMI Coalition had as its goal a technology to enable content owners to exercise much better control over their content than the Internet, as it originally stood, granted them. Using encryption, SDMI hoped to develop a standard that would allow the content owners to say, "This music cannot be copied," and have a computer respect that command. The technology was to be part of a trusted system of control that would get content owners to trust the system of the Internet much more. When SDMI thought it was close to a standard, it set up a competition. In exchange for providing contestants with the code to an SDMI encrypted bit of content, contestants were to try to crack it. If they did, report the problems to the consortium. Felton and his team figured out the encryption system quickly. He and the team saw the weakness of the system as a type. many encryption systems would suffer the same weakness, and Felton and his team thought it worthwhile to point this out and those who study encryption. Let's review just what Felton is doing. Again, this is the United States. We have a principle of free speech. We have this principle not just because it is the law, but also because it is a really great idea. A strongly protected tradition of free speech is likely to encourage a wide range of criticism. That criticism is likely, in turn, to improve the system or people or ideas criticized. What Felton and his colleagues were doing was publishing a paper describing the weakness in technology. They were not spreading free music or building and deploying this technology. The paper was an academic essay, unintelligible to most people, but it clearly showed the weakness in the SDMI system and why SDMI would not, as presently constituted, succeed. What links these two, ibopet.com and Felton, is the letters that they received. ibopet.com received a letter from Sony about the ibopet.com hack. Though a jazz dancing dog is perfectly legal, Sony wrote, "Your site contains information providing the means to circumvent Iboware's copy protection protocol, constituting a violation of the anti-circumvention provisions in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act." And though an academic paper describing the weakness in a system of encryption should also be perfectly legal, Felton received a letter from the RIAA lawyer that read, "Any disclosure of information gained from participating in the public challenge would be outside the scope of activities permitted by the agreement and could subject you and your research team to actions under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, DMCA. In both cases, this weirdly Orwellian law was invoked to control the spread of information. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act made spreading such information an offense. The DMCA was enacted as a response to copyright owners' first fears about cyberspace. The fear was that copyright control was effectively dead. The response was to find technologies that might compensate. These new technologies would be copyright protection technologies, technologies to control the replication and distribution of copyrighted material. They were designed as code to modify the original code of the Internet to reestablish some protection for copyright owners. The DMCA was a bit of law intended to back up the protection of this code designed to protect copyrighted material. It was, we could say, legal code intended to buttress software code, which itself was intended to support legal code of copyright. But the DMCA was not designed merely to protect copyrighted works to the extent copyright law protected them. Its protection, that is, did not end at the line that copyright law drew. The DMCA regulated devices that were designed to circumvent copyright protection measures. It was designed to ban those devices. Whether or not the use of the copyrighted material made possible by that circumvention would have been a copyright violation. ibopet.com and Felton made the point. The Ibo hack circumvented a copy protection system for the purpose of enabling the dog to dance jazz. That enablement, no doubt, involved the use of copyrighted material. But as ibopet.com's site was non-commercial and the use did not enable subsequent copyright infringements, there's no doubt that ibopet.com's hack was fair use of Sony copyrighted material. Yet fair use is not a defense to the DMCA. The question is not whether the use of copyrighted material was a copyright violation. The question is whether a copyright protection system was circumvented. The threat against Felton was more attenuated, but it followed the same line of reasoning. By publishing a paper describing how a copyright protection system could be circumvented, the RIAA lawyer suggested Felton himself was distributing a circumvention technology. Thus, even though he was not himself infringing on anyone's copyright, his academic paper was enabling others to infringe others' copyright. The bizarreness of these arguments is captured in a cartoon drawn in 1981 by Paul Conrad. At the same time, a court in California had held that the VCR could be banned because it was a copyright-infringing technology. It enabled consumers to copy films without the permission of the copyright owner. No doubt, there were uses of the technology that were legal. Fred Rogers, a.k.a. Mr. Rogers, for example, had testified in that case that he wanted people to feel free to tape Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. Some public stations, as well as commercial stations, programmed the neighborhood at hours when some children cannot use it. I think that it's a real service to families to be able to record such programs and show them at appropriate times. I have always felt that with the advent of all this new technology that allows people to tape the neighborhood off the air, and I'm speaking for the neighborhood because that's what I produce, and that they become much more active in the programming of their family's television life. Very frankly, I'm opposed to people being programmed by others. My whole approach in broadcasting has always been, you are an important person just the way you are. You can make healthy decisions. Maybe I'm going on too long, but I just feel that anything that allows a person to be more active in control of his or her life in a healthy way is important. Even though there were uses that were legal, because there were some uses that were illegal, the court held the companies producing the VCRs responsible. This led Conrad to draw the cartoon below, which we can adopt, to the DMCA. No argument I have can top this picture, but let me try to get close. The anti-circumvention provisions of the DMCA target copyright circumvention technology. Circumvention technologies can be used for different ends. They can be used, for example, to enable massive pirating of copyrighted material, a bad end. Or they can be used to enable the use of particular copyrighted material in ways that would be considered fair use, a good end. A handgun can be used to shoot a police officer or a child. Most would agree that such a use is bad. Or a handgun can be used for target practice to protect against an intruder. At least some would say that such a use would be good. It, too, is a technology that has both good and bad uses. The obvious point of Conrad's cartoon is the weirdness of a world where guns are legal despite the harm they can do, while VCRs and circumvention technologies are illegal. Flash, no one ever died from copyright circumvention. Yet the law bans circumvention technologies absolutely, despite the potential that they might do some good, but permits handguns despite the obvious and tragic harm that they do. The IBO and RIAA examples demonstrate how copyright owners are changing the balance that copyright law grants. Using code, copyright owners restrict fair use. Using the DMCA, they punish those who would attempt or evade the restrictions on fair use that they impose through code. Technology becomes a means by which fair use can be erased. The law of the DMCA backs up that erasing. This is how code becomes law. The controls built into the technology of copy and access protection become rules, the violation of which is also a violation of the law. In this way, the code extends the law, increasing its regulation, even if the subject it regulates, activities that would otherwise plainly constitute fair use, is beyond the reach of the law. Code becomes law. Code extends the law. Code thus extends the control that copyright owners affect. At least for those copyright holders with the law who can write the nasty letters that Felton and IboPet.com received. There is one final aspect of the interaction between architecture and the law that contributes to the force of copyrights regulation. This is the ease with which infringements of the law can be detected. For contrary to the rhetoric common at the birth of cyberspace that on the internet, no one knows you're a dog. Increasingly, given changing technologies deployed on the internet, it is easy to find the dog who committed the illegal wrong. The technologies of the internet are open to snoops as well as sharers, and the snoops are increasingly good at tracking down the identity of those who violate the rules. For example, imagine you were part of a Star Trek fan club. You gathered every month to share trivia and maybe to extend a kind of fan fiction about the show. One person would play Spock, another Captain Kirk. The characters would begin with a plot from a real story, then simply continue it. Before the internet, this was, in effect, a totally unregulated activity. No matter what happened inside your club room, you would never be interfered by the copyright police. You were free in that space to do as you wished with this part of our culture. You were allowed to build on it as you wished without fear of legal control. But if you moved your club onto the internet and made it generally available for others to join, the story would be very different. Bots scouring the net for trademark and copyright infringement would quickly find your site. Your posting of fan fiction, depending upon the ownership of the series that you're depicting, could well inspire a lawyer's threat, and ignoring that lawyer's threat would be extremely costly indeed. The law of copyright is extremely efficient. The penalties are severe, and the process is quick. This change in the effective force of the law is caused by a change in the ease of which the law can be enforced. That change, too, shifts the law's balance radically. It is as if your cars transmitted the speed at which you traveled every moment that you drove. That would be just one step before the state started issuing tickets based upon the data you transmitted. That is, in effect, what's happening here. Market concentration. So copyright's duration has increased dramatically, tripled in the past 30 years, and copyright scope has increased as well, from regulating only publishers to now regulating just about everyone. And copyright's reach has changed, as every action becomes a copy and hence presumptively regulated. And as technologists find better ways to control the use of content, and as copyright is increasingly enforced through technology, copyright's force changes too. Misuse is easier to find and easier to control. This regulation of the creative process, which began as a tiny regulation governing a tiny part of the market for creative work, has become the single most important regulator of creativity there is. It is a massive expansion in the scope of the government's control over innovation and creativity. It would be totally unrecognizable to those who gave birth to copyright control. Still, in my view, all of these changes would not matter much if it weren't for one more change that we must also consider. This is a change that is in some sense the most familiar, though its significance and scope are not well understood. It is the one that creates precisely the reason to be concerned about all the other changes that I have described. This is the change in the concentration and integration of the media. In the past 20 years, the nature of media ownership has undergone a radical alteration, caused by changes in the legal rules governing the media. Before this change happened, the different forms of media were owned by separate media companies. Now, the media is increasingly owned by only a few companies. Indeed, after the changes that the FCC announced in June 2003, most expected that within a few years we would live in a world where just three companies control more than 85% of the media. These changes are of two sorts, the scope of concentration and its nature. Changes in the scope are the easier ones to describe. As Senator John McCain summarized the data produced in the FCC's review of media ownership, five companies control 85% of our media sources. The five recording labels of Universal Music Group, BMG, Sony Music Entertainment, Warner Music Group, and EMI control 84.8% of the U.S. music market. The five largest cable companies pipe programming to 74% of the cable subscribers nationwide. The story with radio is even more dramatic. Before deregulation, the nation's largest radio broadcasting conglomerate owned fewer than 75 stations. Today, one company owns more than 1,200 stations. During that period of consolidation, the total number of radio owners dropped by 34%. Today, in most markets, the two largest broadcasters control 74% of that market's revenues. Overall, just four companies control 90% of the nation's radio advertising revenues. Newspaper ownership is becoming more concentrated as well. Today, there are 600 fewer daily newspapers in the United States than there were 80 years ago, and 10 companies control half of the nation's circulations. There are 20 major newspaper publishers in the United States. The top 10 film studios receive 99% of all film revenue. The 10 largest cable companies account for 85% of all cable revenue. This is a market far from the free press the framers sought to protect. Indeed, it is a market that is quite well protected by the market. Concentration in size alone is one thing. The more invidious change is in the nature of that concentration. As author James Fallows put in a recent article about Rupert Murdoch, Murdoch's companies now constitute a production system unmatched in its integration. They supply content, Fox movies, Fox TV shows, Fox-controlled sports broadcasts, plus newspaper and books. They sell the content to the public and to advertisers in newspapers, on the broadcast network, on the cable channels, and they operate the physical distribution system through which the content reaches its customers. Murdoch's satellite systems now distribute News Corp content in Europe and Asia. If Murdoch becomes DirecTV's largest single owner, that system will serve the same function in the United States. The pattern with Murdoch is the pattern of modern media, not just large companies owning many radio stations, but a few companies owning as many outlets of media as possible. A picture describes this pattern better than 1,000 words could do. This picture shows a picture of a home surrounded by boxes pointing in towards it. Written on the boxes are Viacom, AOL, Time Warner, News Corp, Clear Channel, and Disney. Backing these boxes, pushing in on the home, are all the assets that these different companies own. Does this concentration matter? Will it affect what is made or what is distributed? Or is it merely a more efficient way to produce and distribute content? My view was that concentration wouldn't matter. I thought it was nothing more than a more efficient financial structure. But now, after reading and listening to a barrage of creators try to convince me to the contrary, I'm beginning to change my mind. Here's a representative story that begins to suggest how this integration may matter. In 1969, Norman Lear created a pilot for All the Family. He took the pilot to ABC. The networks didn't like it. It was too edgy, they told Lear. Make it again. Lear made a second pilot, more edgy than the first. ABC was exasperated. You've missed the point, they told Lear. We wanted less edgy, not more. Rather than comply, Lear simply took the show elsewhere. CBS was happy to have the series. ABC could not stop Lear from walking. The copyrights that Lear held assured an independence from network control. The network did not control these copyrights because the law forbade the networks from controlling the content they syndicated. The law required a separation between the networks and the content providers. That separation would guarantee Lear freedom. And as late as 1992, because of these rules, the vast majority of primetime television, 75% of it, was independent of the networks. In 1994, the FCC abandoned the rules that required this independence. After that change, the networks quickly changed the balance. In 1985, there were 25 independent television production studios. In 2002, only 5 independent television studios remained. In 1992, only 15% of new series were produced for networks by a company it controlled. Last year, the percentage of shows produced by controlled companies more than quintupled to 77%. In 1992, 16 new series were produced independently of conglomerate control. Last year, there was one. In 2002, 75% of primetime television was owned by the networks that ran it. In the 10-year period between 1992 and 2002, the number of primetime television hours per week produced by the network studios increased over 200%, whereas the number of primetime television hours per week produced by independent studios decreased 63%. Today, another Norman Lear with another All in the Family would find that he had the choice either to make the show less edgy or to be fired. The content of any show developed for a network is increasingly owned by the network. While the number of channels has increased dramatically, the ownership of those channels has narrowed to even smaller and smaller few. As Barry Diller said to Bill Moyers, "Well, if you have companies that produce, that finance, that air on their channel, and then distribute worldwide everything that goes through their controlled distribution system, then what you get is fewer and fewer actual voices participating in the process. We used to have dozens and dozens of thriving independent production companies producing television programs. Now you have less than a handful. This narrowing has an effect on what is produced. The product of such large concentrated networks is increasingly homogeneous, increasingly safe, increasingly sterile. The product of news shows from networks like this is increasingly tailored to the message that the network wants to convey. This is not the Communist Party, though from the inside it must feel a bit like the Communist Party. No one can question without risk of consequence. Not necessarily banishment to Siberia, but punishment nonetheless. Independent, critical, different views are quashed. This is not the environment for a democracy. Economics itself offers a parallel that explains why this integration affects creativity. Clay Christensen has written about the innovator's dilemma, the fact that large traditional firms find it rational to ignore new breakthrough technologies that compete with their core business. The same analysis could help explain why large traditional media companies would find it rational to ignore new culture trends. Lumbering giants not only don't, but should not sprint. Yet if the field is only open to the giants, there will be far too little sprinting. I don't think we know enough about the economics of the media market to say with certainty what concentration and integration will do. The efficiencies are important, and the effect on culture is hard to measure. But there is a quintessentially obvious example that does strongly suggest concern. In addition to the copyright wars, we're in the middle of the drug wars. Government policy is strongly directed against the drug cartels. Criminal and civil courts are filled with the consequences of this battle. Let me hereby disqualify myself from any possible appointment to any position in government by saying, I believe this war is a profound mistake. I am not pro-drugs. Indeed, I come from a family once wrecked by drugs, though the drugs that wrecked my family were all quite illegal. I believe this war is a profound mistake because the collateral damage from it is so great as to make waging the war insane. When you add together the burdens on the criminal justice system, the desperation of generations of kids whose only real economic opportunities are as drug warriors, the querying of constitutional protections because of the constant surveillance this war requires, and most profoundly, the total destruction of the legal system of many South American nations because of the power of the local drug cartels, I find it impossible to believe that the marginal benefit in reduced drug consumption by Americans could possibly outweigh these costs. You may not be convinced. That's fine. We live in a democracy, and it is through votes that we are able to choose policy. But to do that, we depend fundamentally upon the press to help inform Americans about the issues. Beginning in 1998, the Office of National Drug Control Policy launched a media campaign as part of the War on Drugs. The campaign produced scores of short films, clips about issues related to illegal drugs. In one series, the Nick and Norm series, two men are in a bar discussing the idea of legalizing drugs as a way to avoid some of the collateral damages from the war. One advances an argument in favor of drug legalization. The other responds in a powerful and effective way against the argument of the first. In the end, the first guy changes his mind. Hey, it's television. The plug at the end is a damning attack on the pro-legalization campaign. Fair enough? It's a good ad. Not terribly misleading, it delivers its message well, it's a fair and reasonable message. But let's say you think it is the wrong message, and you'd like to run a counter-commercial. Say you want to run a series of ads that try to demonstrate the extraordinary collateral harm that comes from the war on drugs. Can you do it? Well, obviously, these ads cost lots of money. Assume you raise the money. Assume a group of concerned citizens donates all the money in the world to help you get your message out. Can you be sure your message will be heard then? No, you cannot. Television stations have a general policy of avoiding controversial ads. Ads sponsored by the government are deemed uncontroversial. Ads disagreeing with the government are controversial. This selectivity might be thought inconsistent with the First Amendment, but the Supreme Court has held that stations have the right to choose what they will run. Thus, the major channels of commercial media will refuse one side of a crucial debate the opportunity to present its case, and the courts will defend the rights of the stations to be biased. I'd be happy to defend the network's rights as well. If we lived in a media market that was truly diverse, but concentration in the media throws that condition into doubt. if a handful of companies control access to the media, and that handful of companies gets to decide which political positions it will allow to be promoted on its channels, then, in an obvious and important way, concentration matters. You might like the position the handful of companies select, but you should not like a world in which a mere few get to decide which issues the rest of us get to know about. Together. There is something innocent and obvious about the claim of the copyright warriors that the government should protect my property. In the abstract, it is obviously true and ordinarily totally harmless. No sane sort who is not an anarchist could disagree. But when we see how dramatically this property has changed, when we recognize how it might now interact with both technology and markets to mean that the effective constraint on the liberty to cultivate our culture is dramatically different, the claim begins to seem less innocent and obvious, given 1, the power of technology to supplement the law's control, and 2, the power of concentrated markets to weaken the opportunity for dissent, if strictly enforcing the massively expanded property rights granted by the copyright fundamentally changes the freedom within this culture to cultivate and build upon our past, then we have to ask whether this property should be redefined. Not starkly or absolutely. My point is not that we should abolish copyright or go back to the 18th century. That would be a total mistake. Disastrous for most important creative enterprises within our culture today. But there is a space between 0 and 1, internet culture notwithstanding, and these massive shifts in effective power of copyright regulation tied to increased concentration of the content industry and resting in the hands of technology that will increasingly enable control over the use of culture should drive us not to consider whether another adjustment is called for. Not an adjustment that increases copyright's power, not an adjustment that increases its term, rather an adjustment to restore the balance that has traditionally defined copyright regulation. A weakening of that regulation to strengthen creativity. Copyright law has not been a rock of Gibraltar. It's not a set of constant commitments that, for some mysterious reason, teenagers and geeks not flout. Instead, copyright power has grown dramatically in a short period of time as the technologies of distribution and creation have created and as lobbyists have pushed for more control by copyright holders. Changes in the past, in response to changes in technology, suggest that we may well need similar changes in the future. And these changes have to be reductions in the scope of copyright in response to the extraordinary increase in control that technology and the market enable. For the single point that is lost in this war on pirates is a point that we see only after surveying the range of these changes. When you add together the effect of changing law, concentrated markets, and changing technology, together they produce an astonishing conclusion. Never in our history have fewer had a legal right to control more of the development of our culture than now. Not when copyrights were perpetual, for when copyrights were perpetual, they affected only that precise creative work. Not when only publishers had the tools to publish for the market. Then was much more diverse. Not when there were only 3 television networks, for even then, newspapers, film studios, radio stations, and publishers were independent of the networks. Never has copyright protected such a range of rights, including a broad range of actors, for a term that was remotely as long. This form of regulation of a tiny part of the creative energy of a nation at the founding, is now a massive regulation of the overall creative process. Law plus technology plus the market now interact to turn this historically benign regulation into the most significant regulation of culture that our free society has known. This has been a long chapter. Its point can now be briefly stated. At the start of this book, I distinguish between commercial and non-commercial culture. In the course of this chapter, I have distinguished between copying a work and transforming it. We can now combine these two distinctions and draw a clear map of the changes that copyright law has undergone. In 1970, the law looked like this. There's a chart showing commercial and non-commercial, and they're publish and transform. Commercial, copyright, transform, free. Non-commercial, free to publish. Non-commercial, free to transform. The act of publishing a map, chart, and book was regulated by copyright law. Nothing else was. Transformations were free, and as copyright attached only with registration, and only those who intended to benefit commercially would register. Copying those publishing of non-commercial works was also free. By the end of the 19th century, the law had changed like this. Another chart, commercial and non-commercial, publish and transform. Commercial, publish, copyright, transform, copyright. Non-commercial, free, non-commercial, transform, free. Derivative works were now regulated by copyright law. If published, which again, given the economics of publishing at the time, means it offered commercially. But non-commercial publishing and transformation were still essentially free. In 1909, the law changed to regulate copies, not publishing, and after this change, the scope of the law was tied to technology. As the technology of copying became more prevalent, the reach of the law expanded. Thus, by 1975, photocopying machines became more common. We could say that the law began to look like this. Commercial and non-commercial, publish, transform, commercial, publish, copyright, commercial, transform, copyright, non-commercial, copyright, free, and then non-commercial, transform, free. The law was interpreted to reach non-commercial copying through, say, copy machines, but still much of the copying outside of the commercial market remained free. But the consequence of the emergence of digital technology, especially in the context of digital networks, means that the law now looks like this. Commercial, non-commercial, publish and transform. Commercial, publish, copyright. Commercial, transform, copyright. Non-commercial, publish, copyright. Non-commercial, transform, copyright. Every realm is governed by copyright law. Whereas before, most creativity was not. The law now regulates the full range of creativity, commercial or not, transformative or not, with the same rules designed to regulate commercial publishers. Obviously, copyright law is not the enemy. The enemy is regulation that does no good. So the question that we should be asking just now is whether extending the regulations of copyright law into each of these domains actually does any good. I have no doubt that it does good in regulating commercial copying, but I also have no doubt that it does more harm than good when regulating, as it regulates just now. Non-commercial copying and, especially non-commercial transformation, and increasingly, for the reasons sketched especially in chapters 7 and 8, one might well wonder whether it does more harm than good for commercial transformation. More commercial transformative work would be created if derivative rights were more sharply restricted. The issue is therefore not simply whether copyright is property. Of course, copyright is a kind of property, and of course, as with any property, the state ought to protect it. But first impressions notwithstanding, historically, this property right, as with all property rights, has been crafted to balance the important need to give authors and artists incentives with the equally important need to assure access to creative work. This balance has always been struck in light of new technologies, and for almost half of our tradition, the copyright did not control at all the freedom of others to build upon or transform a creative work. American culture was born free, and for almost 180 years, our country consistently protected a vibrant and rich free culture. We achieved that free culture because our law respected important limits on the scope of interest protected by property. The very birth of copyright as a statutory right recognized those limits by granting copyright owners protection for a limited time only, the story of Chapter 6. The tradition of fair use is animated by similar concerns that is increasingly under strain as the costs of increasing any fair use right become unavoidably high, the story of Chapter 7. Adding statutory rights where market might stifle innovation is another familiar limit on property right that copyright is, Chapter 8. And granting archives and libraries a broad freedom to collect claims of property notwithstanding is a crucial part of guaranteeing the soul of culture, Chapter 9. Free cultures, like free markets, are built with property, but the nature of the property that builds a free culture is a very different one from the extremist version that dominates the debate today. Free culture is increasingly the casualty in this war on piracy, in response to a real, if not yet qualified, threat that the technologies of the Internet present to 20th century business models for producing and distributing culture. The law and the technology are being transformed in a way that will undermine our tradition of free culture. The property right, that is, copyright, is no longer the balance right it was or was intended to be. The property right, that is, copyright, has become unbalanced, tilted toward the extreme. The opportunity to create and transform becomes weakened in a world in which creation requires permission and creativity must check with a lawyer.